about it. So maybe the future isn't so, maybe this was our present world speaker, you see. Something that I neglected to do at the outset, which I really do want to do, and that is to introduce the two other people who are primarily responsible for conducting and creating this computer fair. One is Bob Reiling, who many of you know locally, but I'd like to introduce him. Bob, why don't you stand up? Bob, probably prostrate on the table. Rick, where are you? I'd like to introduce Rick Baklinski over here, who, without whom the computer fair simply wouldn't be. Incidentally, Rick is the one who invented the name of Dr. Dobb's Journal of Computer Calisthenics and Orthodontia. I'm not quite so inventive. East Coast, and move to the West Coast. Oh, one other thought relative to Mr. Pohl's comments. He spoke at the beginning about that we'd had no visitors from the planet Clarion. However, I think we have been visited by a Star Trek planet called Altair. Oh, wow. Only a computer freak would do something like that. Okay, dropping back from perhaps the future world and the East Coast to the West Coast and the present world, and perhaps you'll think it's more futuristic than present, I'd like to introduce John Whitney, who is a pioneer computer filmmaker and graphics artist. He's been working at it for, I think, perhaps 15 or 20 years now, including working under grants from the Guggenheim Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and then that obscure corporation called IBM. He started out working with monster machines, and now he works with a machine in his home, just like many of us do. But he produces very exotic computer graphics work. Among other things, he invented the slit scan technology that was used in some of the flashier of the flashes out of 2001. He's a lecturer in the art department at the University of California in Los Angeles, and I think you will be delighted with his presentation. John Whitney.
Thank you, Tim. Being a lecturer at a university, I'm going to give you a sample lesson. I think it's possible now to do a kind of a music appreciation course or something similar to that, and to try to bring out some of the kind of potentials that exist with the computer graphics capability that we have already today. For creating a visual art that would have some sort of a valid structure in time. And the real source of inspiration for anyone thinking in this direction has to be music, because it is the really definitive art that just goes on in time and has its essence is its temporal structure. So let's start with a little film that I'll try to describe and talk about when we're running it. I think we ought to put out, before you start the projector, let's blow out the candles and try to get the room as dark as possible. Where would the lights be? Great. Well, this is a little exercise or demonstration that consists of 24 hexagonal figures that are mounted concentrically, and they're going to start on a little race course around a circle. The largest one, the 24th, is going to go 24 times faster than the smallest one, so that 24 will go around, or the largest one will go around 24 times, the smallest one will go around once. And up there is a little white dot, which is functioning as a sort of a clock. And so now, with those rules, let's follow what happens a quarter of the way around. They've divided themselves into four, and so this suggests something. What happens when it gets a third of the way around? Now they've divided themselves into three. Already you can guess what will happen when they get halfway around. Halfway. There's no magic to this, and it's a very simple thing, and it's interesting that it has a lot of ramifications, and I'll try to suggest some of them. But we'll continue with picking up the fractions. From now on, we've seen the last half. There can only be one half. We've seen the last third. We're going to watch the fractions as they continue on around. There's the last quarter, the last four. The next will be five. And now I'm going to sort of step so that you can see what's happening to the figures a little bit. Actually, we're passing other fractions, but we're not stopping, and so you don't realize it. Here we are, five. We're going on, I'll tell you, we're going on right on through six, seven, eight. Nothing magic about that. This is a straightforward arithmetic. If you start any plurality of figures going around some sort of a race course, and their relationships are simple, like the number 24 is going 24 times faster, number 23 is going 23 times, and 22, 22 times, and 1, 1 time. These are inevitable developments that take place. I'd like to describe some of that with this projector here. Is determined by these kind of straightforward numerical relationships. Now, the interesting thing is, oddly enough, that these kind of numerical relationships have been at the basis, at the foundation of music since the beginning of time. Music, possibly older than language itself, has involved this kind of relationship in simple whole number relations. Pythagoras was the first one possibly to have conceived this and described it. But we understand that the relationship of the octave, which is the most common interval that we know in all music and known by almost all cultures, the relationship of the frequencies of an octave is a relationship of simply 2 to 1. And the next most common relationship that we have is the ratio of the fifth, which is a relation of 2 to 3. The next most common in the scale, ongoing scale, is 3 to 4, and that's the interval of the fourth, and they continue that way right on through. Strangely enough, this creates, as a musical experience, a hierarchy of musical order. And both rhythmically and melodically, we are constantly, the composer has constantly relied upon these simple relationships, and we are drawn to the most obvious interval of the octave and then these subsequently less demanding or less powerful forces that are contained in the subsequent steps. Well, let's get to that a little later. I'm certainly must say that I'm not involved with sound in a direct relationship of this sort that I'm describing to you now. I wonder what the trouble is. It's a self-threading problem. These projectors are very difficult because they're automatically self-threadable.
But we all know, never trust a machine.
You ought to reprogram the thing.
And we're still light part.
All right. Now here is the 360 points around a circle. On the right, on my side, at the bottom, is point number 1. On the left, at the bottom, is point number 360. Is that focused?
No.
What? The window. Well, that's just an arbitrary, you know, I think if you've had any experience with CRT graphics, you can define the frame or the window. And so the picture is allowed to go to that predefined limit and then required to jump back to. What were the limits? Well, it's just an arbitrary figure comfortable inside the frame. How's too general a question? I mean,
how close are we to being able to do it with our own machines in our own homes?
Yeah, that's good. Well, I've been using, I was loaned by Tektronix a 4051 in through the winter of this year. And I found it quite satisfactory. The interesting point is I had been arguing for the last two or three years that having practically ruined my health and experiencing working midnight hours from midnight on over these many years, being the lowest creature on the hierarchy of big central systems, that I could... I could do 10 times the work with a machine that went 10 times slower than the ones I've been accustomed to. And that's about the way it is. The 4051 is certainly a satisfactory machine. And the first half of the film that I'm working on now was done there with the 4051. Yes, Ted.
In the first picture, you show us a circle as opposed to 360 dots, then they gradually spreads. Are the individual dots moving only sideways? That's the first question. And why is it that they slow down? I thought you were speeding them up gradually.
They are speeding up on a sine curve and then they slow down. I've got that part of the sine curve. And indeed, they are only moving in X direction.
Which is redefined when you have a pentagonal split.
Yeah, that's in that case. That in fact, that arrangement there is the liberties that I can take with my own optical printing capability. After I generated the original material that you have been seeing, I subsequently re-photographed that in the optical printer using color filters and color film. And at that point, I can reduce the size. I can position it any place I want, and I can run it forward or backward. No, that's too much for the 4051 basic. And in fact, we've got to go a little bit farther before we can do that sort of thing as a practical secondary level of programming. It's not by any means out of the question. In fact, it's the most logical thing to happen, but it hasn't happened. At least I think it would be just tediously, just hopelessly too slow on a 4051.
So all that, your base is circle, and like you were doing this pentagonal thing, that was all done in optical.
Yeah, the positioning.
The basic one is zapped down and multiplied.
Right. My procedure has been for all these recent films to acquire, as I am again right now, sort of a library of basic actions, and then I work with them almost a doubling of the period involved in generating those on the computer. I spend another equally long period and tiresome period in my own optical printing.
You work 16 millimeter only?
No, my originals are on 35 millimeter black and white film, and I reduce to 16 I work in 16 color exclusively. Are we ready with the next film? Oh yes, down with the lights. No, I don't think I would have. No, I feel very strongly that what we have here is a new source of instrumentation and for a new kind of art. I'm not very hot on the idea of computers doing art any more than that. I was always enthusiastic about the way pianos play sonatas. Well, that's my point. I'm trying to say that we have our hands on that another huge domain of resources, harmonic resources, that really parallels the domain of harmonic resources that the composer has known for 10 or 15 centuries and for every culture around the world. Music is a very, very universal human phenomenon. And it's been a great delight for everyone from almost, well, children are born with the Muzak running over the hospital. So that's where it begins. And they sing hymns when you die. So it's with you pretty much from the cradle to the grave. And I'm thinking that somehow we're getting very close to the same sort of a rich mine of resources for a visual art now. Yes? I would hope to see more control, and I hope that this is a clue to ways of getting into control. And I'm sure that is going to be the kind of development that will take place.
Are you acquainted with the Love Light thing that's being done in Boston now, with lasers and laser control in the planetarium?
No, but I suspect it's very much like the one that's out at the laserium at Griffith Park. And
yes.
I think the same company, they've been enormously successful, and they have them at Planetaria or around the country now. Oh, yes. Next question. Yes?
I was wondering, a lot of the figures are similar to liturgy patterns that are seen on the oscilloscope, and I was wondering if possibly you could get a color CRT and have like computer-controlled waveform generators and oscilloscope control to do that same thing in real time.
Well, I think so, but did you hear the question? The question is, could we do this with analog systems and in real time? It's a complex and it's an involved question. It has to do with the nature of art, in a sense. I don't want to get pompous about it, but the problems are, take, for example, look at the situation of Beethoven. Beethoven probably was 6 years old, was starting to hammer on a piano. He probably was playing very well by age six. He was training a mind, hand, ear relationship and developing a kind of skill which paid off for him. By the time he was in his teens, he was a European novelty of great value. He was in the courts, he was entertaining. He was a very important improviser. He was able to play all evening with pure improvisation, and he had a famous reputation. He could have died happy just with the success of his art of improvisation. And yet, on the contrary, that same man devoted himself to the most unbelievably agonizing reworking of the compositions that we know of from him today. In other words, there's a direct need for true interactive man-machine communication and training, which is what you get as a child learning to perform with any of the musical instruments. But then finally, the art of composing music that really has validity and really sticks on your mind is a matter of the most contemplative and agonizing study and often a very, very complex work and creation.
Thank you. he was dragged to the banks of the Tiber and his hands were chopped off, because I remember it. Now, I think what happened was that volume was computer typeset. But honestly, it was in my copy. I don't know what happened.
Is it true that the people from Altair came by bus?
It is true that they came from people Altair came by bus because they wanted to come by BART, but it was on a weekend and they couldn't do it.
Well, that's true. There are all kinds of. You get into the world of scales, and you're into a veritable nightmare of opinion and so on. I can go by the most rudimentary, elemental Pythagorean concepts. I seem to feel that we are drawn by these simple harmonic relationships of the, and you can't go much beyond that if you try to be analytical. And a lot of mathematicians have wanted to be, you know. Who was a Frenchman, Rameau, tried and failed. Schillinger in this century tried and failed to really nail it down. I don't want to labor that. I'm just simply saying that harmonically, perceptually, we seem to arrive at, we can create anticipation, expectations, and gratify those expectations, deny them at another moment, and organize them. And that's what the composer, that's his game. It's been his game for centuries. And now it's going to be our game in a visual world. That's all I can say. That gets very complicated. It's certainly true. The 19th century saw harmonics almost done in. By the time of you're into the 20th century, Arnold Schoenberg is practically ready to kick the whole thing out and start over. And 20th century composers have almost all of them rejected this out of hand. I think there is a trend now to backtrack a little bit and not be so total in our rejection. In my opinion, it's essential. We all music creates expectations and satisfy them by means of harmonic perception. Yes?
I was going to ask something along that same line, that is the 20th century music went away from the repetition to a serial mode, and I'm wondering what the visual analog of that is.
Yeah. Well, I can't get into that. I suspect, much of the motivation of the 20th century composer has been a reaction against the beautiful success of the 19th century. And we're not burdened with those problems. They're their problems, not ours.
On that last film we saw, how closely are you working with the visual to the sound? Is it the visual first and then the sound is kind of later, or is it played back?
That's a perennial question. I've been exploring all different kinds of relationships. I, in some cases, have composed my own music in the earliest films, and I want, once again, to be able to do that. But at the present time, I have cast about searching various cultures. I've used Indian music, and I've used Iranian. This is a centaur, an Iranian musical instrument. And I've had people perform for me, as was the case in this film and in earlier films. And I've used music of 19th, 17th century composers, and so a lot of jazz, too, at one time. Yeah. No, but I don't know that there's enough in them to be worthy of publishing, but I'm in favor of being very open about this. I think at this time, we would all be better off if we don't make other people's mistakes over again, more than what we can learn from other people.
How about Dr. Dobbs?
Yeah, where is he? Here. All right.
Wasn't a description of this work published in SCCF
Interface
a while ago?
Yeah, I started writing several different articles, and even in the proceedings for this paper, for this conference, there will be a sort of a condensed statement of these some of these ideas.
It's much better in color.
Thanks.
I think this could go on for several hours at a minimum.
I gotta go to Los Angeles.
Yes. John's has to take off for L.A. And are there any other questions for Mr. Pohl? Yes.
Some of that junk you read was my junk, yeah. Well, the question is, why didn't science fiction 35 years ago write about lasers, computers, what was the other thing, navigation system? The answer is, it did, it just didn't use those words. There were robots, which were, in a sense, computers. There were mechanical brains who did hard thinking other people couldn't do. The laser was described as a disintegrator ray or a death ray or a heat ray, but it worked just about like a laser does. It punched an awful lot of electrical energy into a target, severely messing up the target just as a laser does. And the guidance systems were pretty well implicit in the idea of having a spaceship that would do things by itself, you know. 35 or more years ago, Ted Sturgeon wrote a story called Killdozer about a bulldozer that did things by itself. So he did these things. We just didn't use the right terms, or else the real world didn't use the right term. Desperate hand back there. Question is, could the flying saucers really be something from our future instead of from another planet? The general answer to any question of the form, could it be, is yes. The specific answer to this question is, I doubt the hell out of it.
Thank you very much, John Whitney and Frederick Pohl. Good night.